"If those drugs go missing," said Martel, "there's going to be hell to pay."
"Oranges," said Rousseau. "Oranges."
It was at this point that Gabriel interjected himself into the proceedings for the first time. He did so with only the thinnest of introductions and bearing several blank sheets of paper and a pencil and sharpener. For the better part of the next hour, he sat at the side of the man whose life he had turned inside out, and with his help produced composite sketches of the two versions of Khalil the Iraqi, the 2012 version who wore Western clothing, and the version who appeared in Morocco after the attacks on Washington, wearing a traditional jalaba and walking with a noticeable limp. Martel had a famous eye for detail. He had said so himself many times in press interviews, and claimed to never forget a face. He was demanding, too, a trait he revealed fully when Gabriel could not produce a suitable chin for the surgically retooled version of Khalil. They went through three drafts before Martel, with unexpected enthusiasm, gave his approval.
"That's him. That's the man I saw last December."
"You're sure?" pressed Gabriel. "There's no rush. We can do another draft if you like."
"It's not necessary. That's exactly how he looked."
"And the limp?" asked Gabriel. "You never said which leg was injured."
"It was the right."
"You're positive about that?"
"No question."
"Did he offer any explanation?"
"He said he'd been in a car accident."
"He didn't say where." Gabriel studied the finished sketches for a long moment before holding them up for Natalie to see. Her eyes widened involuntarily. Then, regaining her composure, she looked away and nodded slowly. Gabriel set aside the first sketch and contemplated the second at length. It was the new face of terror. It was the face of Saladin. They dragged him upstairs to Madame Sophie's bedroom, smeared the side of his neck with Madame Sophie's blood-red lipstick, and hosed him down with enough of Madame Sophie's perfume that he left a vapor trail as he drove through the early morning light, beaten and burned, toward his villa on the other side of the Baie des Cavaliers. He did not go alone. Nicolas Carnot, otherwise known as Christopher Keller, sat in the passenger seat, Martel's mobile in one hand, a gun in the other. Behind them, in a second vehicle, were four officers of the Alpha Group. Previously they had been employed by Dmitri Antonov at Villa Soleil. Now, like Nicolas Carnot, they were working for Martel. The exact circumstances surrounding their decision to forsake one master for another were cloudy, but such things were liable to happen in Saint-Tropez in the summertime. It was 5:12 exactly when the two vehicles turned into the drive of Martel's villa. Olivia Watson knew this because she had lain awake all night and had rushed to the bedroom window at the sound of car doors opening and closing in the forecourt. Now she feigned sleep as the bed shifted beneath the weight of her errant lover. She rolled over, their eyes met in the half-light.
"Where have you been, Jean-Luc?"
"Business," he murmured. "Go back to sleep."
"Is there a problem?"
"Not anymore."
"I tried to call you, but my phone isn't working. There's no internet either, and our landline is dead."
"There must be an outage." His eyes closed.
"Why is Nicolas downstairs? And who are those other men?"
"I'll explain everything in the morning."
"It is the morning, Jean-Luc."
He was silent. Olivia moved closer.
"You smell like another woman."
"Olivia, please."
"Who was she, Jean-Luc? Where have you been?"
Chapter 42. Paris. The reckoning Paul Rousseau had been dreading occurred early that afternoon at the Interior Ministry in Paris. Like Jean-Luc Martel, he did not meet his fate alone. Gabriel went with him. They crossed the courtyard shoulder to shoulder and marched up the grand staircase to the minister's imposing office, where Rousseau, never one for polite small talk, immediately confessed his operational sins. British intelligence, he said, had identified the source of the assault rifles used in the London attack as a French Moroccan named Nourdine Zakaria, a career criminal connected to one of France's largest drug trafficking networks. Without the authorization of his chief or the Interior Ministry, Rousseau and the Alpha Group had worked with two allied services, the British and, quite obviously, the Israelis, to penetrate the aforementioned network and turn its leader into an asset. The operation, he went on, had proven successful, based on intelligence provided by the source, the Alpha Group and its partners could say with moderate confidence that ISIS had seized control of a significant portion of the illicit trade in North African hashish, and that Saladin, the mysterious Iraqi mastermind of the group's external operations division, was likely hiding in Morocco, a former French protectorate. The minister reacted about as well as could be expected, which was not well at all. A tirade ensued, much of it profane. Rousseau offered his resignation. Indeed, he had written out a letter in longhand during the trip north from Provence, and for a long moment it seemed the minister was prepared to accept it. At length, he dropped the letter into his shredder. Ultimate responsibility for protecting the French homeland from terrorist attack, Islamic or otherwise, rested on the minister's narrow shoulders. He was not about to lose a man like Paul Rousseau. "Where is Nur ed-Din Zakaria now?"
"Missing," said Rousseau vaguely.
"Has he gone to the caliphate?" Rousseau hesitated before answering. He was prepared to obfuscate, but in no way would he tell an outright lie. Nur ed-Din Zakaria, he said, quietly, was dead.
"Dead how?" asked the minister.
"I believe it occurred during a business transaction." The minister looked at Gabriel.
"I suppose you had something to do with this?"
Zakaria's demise predated our involvement in this affair, responded Gabriel with lawyerly precision. The minister was not mollified.
"And the leader of the network? Your new asset?"
"His name," said Rousseau, "is Jean-Luc Martel." The minister looked down and rearranged the papers on his desk.
"That would explain your interest in Martel's file on the day your headquarters was bombed."
"It would," said Rousseau, holding his ground.
"Jean-Luc has been the target of numerous inquiries. All have reached the same conclusion that he is not involved in drugs."
"That conclusion," said Rousseau carefully, "is incorrect."
"You know better?"
"I have it on the highest authority."
"Who?"
"Jean-Luc Martel." The minister scoffed.
"Why would he tell you such a thing?"
"He didn't have much of a choice."
"Why?"
"René Devereux." "The name rings a bell."
"It should," said Rousseau. "Where is Devereux now?"
"The same place as Nur ed-Din Zakaria."
"Merde,"
said the minister softly. There was a silence. Dust floated in the sunlight streaming through the window like fish in an aquarium. Rousseau cleared his throat gently, a signal he was about to venture onto treacherous ground.
"I know that you and Martel are friends," he said at last.
"We are acquainted," countered the minister quickly, "but we are not friends."
"Martel would be surprised to hear that. In fact, he invoked your name several times before finally agreeing to cooperate."
The minister could not hide his anger at Rousseau for airing dirty French laundry in front of an outsider, and an Israeli at that.
"What is your point?" he asked.
"My point," said Rousseau, "is that I'm going to need Martel's continued cooperation, which will require a grant of immunity. Such a grant might be sensitive, given your relationship, but it's necessary for the operation to move forward."
"What is your goal?"
"Eliminating Saladin, of course."
"And you intend to use Martel in some sort of operational capacity?"
"It is our only option." The minister made a show of thought.
"You're right. A grant of immunity would be difficult. But if you were to request it—"
"You'll have the paperwork by the end of the day," interjected Rousseau. "Frankly, it's probably for the best. You're not the only one in the current government who's acquainted with Martel." The minister was shuffling papers again.
"We gave you wide latitude when we created the Alpha Group. But needless to say, you've overstepped your authority."
Rousseau accepted the rebuke in penitential silence.
"I won't be kept in the dark any longer. Is that clear?"
"It is, Minister."
"How do you intend to proceed?"
"In the next 10 days, Martel's Moroccan supplier, a man named Mohamed Bakar, is going to send several large shipments of hashish from ports in Libya. It is vital that we intercept them."
"You know the names of the vessels?"
Rousseau nodded.
"Bakar and Saladin will suspect there's an informant.
That is correct.
They'll be angry.
Rousseau smiled. That is our hope, Minister. The first ship, a Maltese-registered floating coffin called the Mediterranean Dream, was not due to leave Libya for another 4 days. Her point of departure was Qoms, a small commercial seaport east of Tripoli. And after a brief stop in Tunis, where she was scheduled to take on a load of produce, she would make directly for Genoa. The other two vessels, one flying a Bahamian flag, the other Panamanian, were both scheduled to depart Sirte in 1 week's time, thus presenting Gabriel and Rousseau with a minor quandary. They agreed that seizing the Mediterranean Dream while the other two vessels were still in port in Libya would be a miscalculation, as it would provide Mohammed Bakar and Saladin an opportunity to reroute the merchandise. Instead, they would wait until all three vessels were in international waters before making their first move. The delay weighed heavily on them both, especially Gabriel, who had watched Saladin's retouched face emerge from the labors of his own hand. He carried the sketch with him always, even to his bed in Jerusalem, where he passed 4 restless nights at the side of his wife. At King Saul Boulevard, he sat through endless briefings on matters he had left in the capable hands of Uzi Navot, but everyone could see his thoughts were elsewhere. During a meeting of the cabinet, his mind drifted as the ministers bickered endlessly. In his notebook he sketched a face partially concealed by the hood of a jalaba. Rousseau woke Gabriel early the next morning with news that the Mediterranean Dream had left Tunis overnight and was now in international waters. But did it contain a concealed shipment of hashish from Morocco? Only one source said it would, the man who lived across the Bay de Cavalier from Dmitri and Sophie Antonov, the man whose many sins had been officially forgiven and who is now under the complete and total control of a consortium of 3 intelligence services. To the uninitiated eye, however, there appeared to be no outward change in his conduct, save for the constant presence at his side of Christopher Keller. Indeed, everywhere Martel went, Keller was sure to follow. To Monaco and Madrid for a pair of previously scheduled business meetings, to Geneva for an eye-opening session with a Swiss banker of questionable ethics, and finally to Marseille, from which the chief of Martel's illicit narcotics division had vanished without a trace, leaving behind 2 dead bodyguards in his electronics shop overlooking the Place Jean Jaurès. The Marseille police were under the impression René Devereux had been killed by an underworld rival. Devereux's associates, including one Henri Villard, were of the same opinion. During a meeting with Martel and Keller in a safe flat near the Gare Saint-Charles, Villard was on edge about the upcoming shipments. He was afraid, rightly, that there had been a leak. Martel calmed his fears and instructed him to collect the cargo in the usual manner. Close scrutiny of the recording produced by the phone in Keller's pocket and of Villard's movements and communications after the meeting suggested Martel had not tried to send a clandestine warning to his old network. The hashish was on its way. The payment was loaded into the pipeline. For both the drug dealers and the spymasters, all systems appeared to be go. The message that would set the next act in motion was delivered through the usual channel, interior minister to interior minister, with no undue sense of urgency. A paid informant inside one of France's most prominent drug gangs claimed that a large shipment of North African hashish would be arriving in Genoa the following day, aboard the Maltese-registered Mediterranean Dream. The Italians, if they didn't have anything better to do, might want to check it out. They did indeed. In fact, units of the Guardia di Finanza, the Italian law enforcement agency responsible for combating drug trafficking, boarded the vessel within minutes of its arrival and began breaking open the containers. Their search would eventually yield 4 metric tons of Moroccan hashish, not a record by any means, but a respectable haul. Afterward, the Italian minister rang his French counterpart and thanked him for the information. The French minister said he was pleased to have been of assistance. While major news in Italy, the seizure attracted little notice in France, least of all in the former fishing village of Saint-Tropez. But when French customs police raided 2 ships the following day, the Toulon-bound Africa Star and the Marseille-bound Caribbean Endeavour, even sleepy Saint-Tropez was impressed. The Africa Star would yield 3 metric tons of hashish, the Caribbean Endeavour only 2. but would also surrender something that Gabriel and Paul Rousseau had not anticipated. A lead cylinder, 40 centimeters in height, 20 in diameter, concealed inside a spool of insulated wire manufactured by a plant in an industrial quarter of Tripoli. The cylinder bore no markings of any kind. Still, the French customs police, who were trained in how to handle potentially hazardous material, knew better than to open it. Calls were made, alarm bells rung, and by early evening the container had been transported securely to a French government laboratory outside Paris, where technicians analyzed the talcum-like powder they found inside. In short order, they determined it was the highly radioactive substance cesium-137, or cesium chloride. Paul Rousseau and the Interior Minister were told of the discovery at 8 that evening, and at 20 minutes past, with Gabriel trailing a step behind, they were rushing through the doors of the Élysée Palace to break the news to the President of the Republic. Saladin was coming for them once again, this time with a dirty bomb. Part 3. The Darkest Corner. Chapter 43. Surrey, England. Precisely how the Americans learned of the concealed shipment of cesium would never be determined to anyone's satisfaction, least of all the French. It was one of those mysteries that would linger long after the operational dust had settled. Nevertheless, they did hear about it, that very night, in fact, and before the sun had risen, they demanded that all the relevant parties traipse to Washington for an emergency summit. Graham Seymour and Amanda Wallace, the cousins, politely demurred. Faced with the prospect of a radiological dispersion device in the hands of Saladin's network, they could not afford to be seen running off to the former colonies for help. They were all for transatlantic cooperation. In fact, they were dangerously dependent on it. But for them it was a simple matter of national pride. And when Gabriel and Paul Rousseau added their objections, the Americans quickly capitulated. Gabriel had been confident of such an outcome. He had a good idea of what the Americans were ultimately after. They wanted Saladin's head on a pike, and the only way they were going to get it was by taking control of Gabriel's operation. It was better to deny them a home field advantage. The 5-hour time difference alone would be enough to keep them off balance. A small delegation was too much to hope for. They arrived on a Boeing jetliner emblazoned with the official seal of the United States and traveled to the site of the conference, a disused MI6 training facility located in a rambling Victorian manor house in Surrey. In a long, noisy motorcade that slashed its way through the countryside as though it were dodging IEDs in the Sunni triangle of occupied Iraq. From one of the vehicles emerged Morris Payne, the agency's new director. Payne was West Point, Ivy League law, private enterprise, and a former deeply conservative member of Congress from one of the Dakotas. He was big and bluff, with a face like an Easter Island statue, and a baritone voice that rattled the beams in the old house's vaulted entrance hall. He greeted Graham Seymour and Amanda Wallace first. They were the hosts, after all, not to mention distant family, before turning the full force of his water cannon personality on Gabriel.
"Gabriel Allon, so good to finally meet you. One of the greats, a legend, truly. We should have done this a long time ago. Adrian tells me you slipped into town without coming to see me. I won't hold that against you. I know you and Adrian go way back. You've done good work together. I hope to continue that tradition."
Gabriel reclaimed his hand and looked at the men surrounding the new director of the world's most powerful intelligence service. They were young and lean and hard, ex-military like their boss, all well-schooled in the sharp elbows of Washington bureaucratic combat. The change from the previous administration was striking. If there was a silver lining, it was that they were reasonably fond of Israel. Perhaps too fond, thought Gabriel. They were proof that one needed to be careful what one wished for. Tellingly, Adrian Carter was not among those in the director's close orbit. He was at that moment crawling out of an SUV along with the rest of the senior operators. Most were unfamiliar to Gabriel. One, however, he recognized. He was Kyle Taylor, the chief of the agency's counterterrorism center. Taylor's presence was a troubling gauge of Langley's intentions. It was said of Taylor that he could drone his mother if he thought it would earn him Carter's job and his 7th-floor office. He wore his relentless ambition like a carefully knotted necktie. Carter, however, looked as though he had just been awakened from a nap. He walked past Gabriel with only the smallest of nods.
"Don't get too close," Carter whispered. "I'm contagious."
"What do you have?"
"Leprosy,"
said Carter. Morris Payne was now pumping Paul Rousseau's hand as though trying to earn his vote. At Graham Seymour's prompting, he moved into the old house's formal dining room, which long ago had been converted into a safe speech facility. There was a basket at the entrance for mobile phones and, on the Victorian sideboard, an array of refreshments that no one touched. Morris Payne sat down at the long rectangular table, flanked on one side by his hard young aides, and on the other by Kyle Taylor, the drone master. Adrian Carter was relegated to the far end, the spot, thought Gabriel, where he could doodle to his heart's content and dream of a job in the private sector. Gabriel lowered himself into his assigned seat and promptly turned over the little name placard that some industrious MI6 functionary had placed there. To his left, and directly across from Morris Payne, was Graham Seymour. And to Seymour's left was Amanda Wallace, who looked as though she feared being splattered by blood. Morris Payne's reputation preceded him. During his brief tenure, he had largely completed the task of transforming the CIA from an intelligence service into a paramilitary organization. The language of espionage bored him. He was a man of action.
"I know you're all in crisis mode," Payne began, "so I won't waste anyone's time. You're all to be commended. You prevented a calamity, or at least delayed one," he added. "But the White House is insisting, and frankly we agree, that Langley needs to take the lead on this and bring the operation home. With all due respect, it makes the most sense. We have the reach and the capability, and we have the technology."
"But we have the source," responded Gabriel, "and all the reach and technology in the world won't replace him. We found him, we burned him, and we recruited him. He's ours."
"And now," said Payne, "you're going to turn him over to us."
"Sorry, Morris, but I'm afraid that's not going to happen." Gabriel glanced toward the end of the table and saw Adrian Carter attempting to suppress a smile. It was hardly an auspicious beginning. Unfortunately, it went rapidly downhill from there. Voices were raised, the table pounded, threats issued. Threats of retaliation, threats of cooperation suspended, and critical aid withheld. Not long ago, Gabriel would have had the luxury of calling the director's bluff. Now he had to proceed with caution. The British were not the only ones who were dependent on Langley's technological might. Israel needed the Americans even more, and under no circumstances could Gabriel afford to alienate his most valuable strategic and operational partner. Besides, for all his bluster and bravado, Morris Payne was a friend who saw the world roughly as Gabriel did. His predecessor, a fluent speaker of Arabic, had made a point of referring to Jerusalem as Al-Quds. Things could definitely be worse. At Graham Seymour's suggestion, they broke for food and drink. Afterward, the mood lightened considerably. Morris Payne admitted that, during the flight across the Atlantic, he had taken the time to review Gabriel's agency file.
"I have to say it was impressive reading."
"I'm surprised you were able to squeeze it aboard your plane." Payne's smile was genuine.
"We both grew up on farms," he said. "Ours was in a remote corner of South Dakota, and yours was in the Valley of Jezreel, next to an Arab village. We didn't have Arabs, only bears and wolves."
This time it was Gabriel who smiled. Payne picked at the edge of a dried-out tea sandwich.
"You've operated in North Africa before. Personally, I mean. You were involved in the Abu Jihad operation in Tunis in 88. You and your team landed on the beach and blasted your way into his villa. You killed him in his study in front of one of his children. He was watching videos of the Intifada at the time."
"That's not true," said Gabriel after a moment.
"Which part?"
"I didn't kill Abu Jihad in front of his family. His daughter walked into the study after he was already dead."
"What did you do?"
"I told her to go take care of her mother. And then I left." A silence fell over the room. It was Morris Payne who broke it.
"Think you can do it again? In Morocco?"
"Are you asking whether we have the capability?"
"Humor me," said Payne.
"Morocco," replied Gabriel, "was well within the operational reach of the office."
"You have decent relations with the king," Payne pointed out. relations that would be endangered if something went wrong.
So do you, replied Gabriel.
Do you intend to work with the Moroccan services?
Did you work with the Pakistanis when you went after bin Laden?
I'll take that as a no.
In all likelihood, said Gabriel, Saladin is hiding in circumstances similar to the way bin Laden was living in Abbottabad. What's more, he enjoys the protection of a drug lord, a man who undoubtedly has friends in high places. Telling the Moroccans about the operation would be like telling Saladin himself.
How sure are you he's really there?
Gabriel placed the two composite sketches on the table. He tapped the first one. Saladin, as he had appeared in the spring of 2012, not long after ISIS had set up shop in Libya. He looks an awful lot like the man I saw in the lobby of the Four Seasons in Georgetown before the attack. Check the hotel security footage. I'm sure you'll come to the same conclusion. Gabriel tapped the second sketch.
And this is the way he looks now, according to a drug dealer named Jean-Luc Martel.
We don't always get to choose our assets, Morris. Sometimes they choose us.
Do you trust him?
Not at all.
Are you prepared to ride into battle with him?
Do you have a better idea? It was obvious he didn't.
What if Saladin doesn't buy it?
He just lost 100 million euros worth of hashish. And the cesium. The American looked at Paul Rousseau.
Have your people been able to identify the source?
The most likely explanation, said Rousseau, is that it came from Russia or one of the other former Soviet republics or satellites. The Soviets were rather indiscriminate in their use of cesium, and they left canisters of the stuff scattered all over the countryside. It's also possible it came from Libya. The rebels and militias overran Libya's nuclear facilities when the regime collapsed. The IAEA was particularly concerned about the Tajura research facility. Perhaps you've heard of it. Payne indicated he had.
When is your government planning to make an announcement?
About what?
The cesium, snapped Payne.
We're not. Payne appeared incredulous. It was Gabriel who explained. An announcement would needlessly alarm the public. More important, it would alert Saladin and his network to the fact that their radiological material had been discovered.
What if another shipment of cesium got through? What happens if a dirty bomb goes off in the middle of Paris, or London, or Manhattan for that matter?
Going public won't make that any more or less likely. Keeping quiet, however, has its advantages. Gabriel placed a hand on Graham Seymour's shoulder. Have you had a chance to read his file, Director Payne? Graham's father worked for British intelligence during the Second World War, the Double Cross Committee. They didn't tell the Germans when they arrested their spies in Britain. They kept those captured spies alive in the minds of their German controllers and used them to feed deceptive information to Hitler and his generals. And the Germans never tried to replace those captured spies because they believed they were still on the job.
So if Saladin thinks the material got through, he won't try to send more, is that what you're saying?
Gabriel was silent.
Not bad, said the American, smiling.
This isn't our first rodeo.
Did you have rodeos in the Jezreel Valley?
No, said Gabriel. We did not. After that, there was just one final piece of business to attend to. It was not something that could be addressed in front of a room full of spies. It was a bilateral issue, one that needed to be handled at the highest level, chief to chief. A quiet side room wouldn't do. Only the walled garden, with its crumbled fountains and weedy footpaths, provided the necessary level of privacy. Despite the fact it was midsummer, the weather was cool and gray, and the overgrown hedges dripped with the rain of a recent shower. Gabriel and Morris Payne walked side by side, slowly, thoughtfully, separated by an inch at most. Viewed from the leaded windows of the old manor house, they made an unlikely pairing. The big, beefy American from the Dakotas, the diminutive Israeli from the ancient valley of Jezreel. Morris Payne, jacketless, gestured broadly as he made his points. Gabriel, listening, rubbed the small of his back and, when appropriate, nodded in agreement. 5 minutes into the conversation, they stopped and turned to face one another, as if in confrontation. Morris Payne jabbed a thick forefinger into Gabriel's chest, hardly an encouraging sign. But Gabriel only smiled and returned the favor. Then he raised his left hand above his head and moved it in a circular fashion while the right hovered palm down at his hip. This time it was Morris Payne who nodded in assent. Those watching from inside understood the significance of the moment. An operational accord had been struck. The Americans would handle the skies and cyber. The Israelis would run the show on the ground and, if presented the opportunity, send Saladin quietly into the night. With that, they turned and started back toward the house. It was clear to those watching from inside that Gabriel was saying something that displeased Morris Payne greatly. There was another pause, and more fingers pointed toward chests. Then Payne turned his big Easter Island face toward the gray sky and gave a capitulatory exhalation of breath. Passing through the meeting room, he snared his jacket from the back of his chair and headed outside, followed by his unsmiling executive staff and, a few paces behind, by Adrian Carter and Kyle Taylor. Gabriel and Graham Seymour waved to them from the portico as though bidding farewell to unwanted company. "Did you get everything you wanted?" asked Seymour through a frozen smile.
"We'll see in a minute."
The scrum of Americans was now beginning to divide into smaller cells, with each cell making for one of the waiting SUVs. Morris Payne stopped suddenly and called out for Carter to join him. Carter detached himself from the rest of the operators and, watched enviously by Kyle Taylor, climbed into the director's SUV.
"How did you manage that?" asked Seymour as the motorcade rumbled into life.
"I asked, nicely.
How long do you reckon he'll survive?"
"That," said Gabriel, "depends entirely on Saladin."
Chapter 44 King Saul Boulevard, Tel Aviv. Next morning, the whole of King Saul Boulevard charged into battle. Even Uzi Navot, who had been tending other operational fires during Gabriel's many prolonged absences, was drawn into the intense planning. It was, as the Americans like to say, all hands on deck. The office had fought for and won the right to retain control of the operation. But with that victory had come the enormous responsibility of getting it right. Not since the American raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad had there been a targeted killing operation of this magnitude. Saladin pulled the levers of a global terror network that had proven itself capable of striking virtually at will, a network that had managed to obtain the radiological material for a dirty bomb and smuggle it to the doorstep of Western Europe. The stakes, they reminded themselves at every turn, could not be any higher. The security of the civilized world quite literally hung in the balance. So, too, did Gabriel's career. Success would only burnish his reputation, but a failure would wipe away all that had come before and add his name to the list of disgraced chiefs who had overreached and then stumbled. If Gabriel was concerned about potential damage to his personal legacy, he didn't show it. Not even to Uzi Navot, who wore a groove in the patch of carpet stretching from his door to the office that once had been his. There was a rumor he had actually tried to talk Gabriel out of it, that he had advised his old rival to make a gift of Jean-Luc Martel and Saladin to the Americans and turn his attention to matters closer to home, like the Iranians. The risks of the operation were far too great, worried Navot, and the rewards too small. At least that was the version of the conversation that flashed through the corridors and cipher-protected rooms of King Saul Boulevard. But Gabriel, according to this account, had held fast to his operation.
"And why wouldn't he?" asked a sage from travel.
Saladin had bested Gabriel that terrible night in Washington. And then, of course, there was Hannah Weinberg, Gabriel's friend and sometime accomplice, whom Saladin had killed in Paris. "No," said the sage. "Gabriel was not going to leave Saladin to his friends in Washington. He was going to put him in the ground. In fact, if given the chance, he was likely to do the deed himself. It wasn't business for Gabriel any longer. It was strictly personal." But a personal stake in an operation was oftentimes perilous. No one recognized this more than Gabriel. His career spoke for itself. Therefore, he leaned heavily on Uzi Navot and the other members of his staff to vet every detail. Organizationally, it was Yaakov Rossman, the chief of special ops, who bore responsibility for planning and executing the mission. And with Gabriel looking over his shoulder, he hastily put the pieces in place. Morocco was not Lebanon or Syria, but it was still hostile territory. More than 20 times the size of Israel, it was a vast country
with a varied terrain of agricultural plains, rugged mountains, Saharan sand deserts, and several large cities, including Casablanca, Rabat, Tangier, Fez, and Marrakesh. Finding Saladin, even with the help of Jean-Luc Martel, was going to be a difficult undertaking. Killing him with no collateral casualties, and then getting out of the country safely, would be one of the sternest tests the office had ever faced. The coastline would be their collaborator, just as it had been in Tunis in April 1988. On that night, Gabriel and a team of 26 elite Sayeret Matkal commandos had come ashore in rubber rafts not far from Abu Jihad's villa, and after completing their mission, they had departed in the same fashion. During the weeks prior to the raid, they had rehearsed the landing countless times on an Israeli beach. They had even built a mock-up of Abu Jihad's seaside villa in the middle of the Negev so that Gabriel could practice making his way from the front door to the upstairs study where the PLO's second-in-command habitually spent his evenings. Such meticulous preparation, however, would not be possible for the operation against Saladin, for they had no idea where in Morocco he was hiding. Truth be told, they could not say for certain he was actually there. What they knew was that a man matching his appearance had been in Morocco several months earlier, after the attack on Washington. In short, they had much less than the Americans had before the raid on Abbottabad, and much more to lose. Which meant they had to be prepared for any eventuality, or at least as many as reasonably possible. A large team would be required, larger than operations past, and each member would need a passport. Identity, the division of the office that maintained Agent Legends, quickly exhausted its existing stock, thus requiring Gabriel to ask his partners, the French, the British, and the Americans, to make up the shortfall. All initially balked. But under Gabriel's unrelenting pressure, all eventually capitulated. The Americans even agreed to reactivate an old U.S. passport that bore the name Jonathan Albright and a photograph that looked vaguely like Gabriel's. "You're not actually thinking of going?" asked Adrian Carter over a secure video link. "In summer? Oh, no," said Gabriel. "I wouldn't dream of it. It's far too hot in Morocco at this time of year." There were cars and motorcycles to rent, open-ended airline tickets to book, and lodgings to acquire. Most of the team would stay in hotels, where they would be under the nose of Morocco's Internal Security Service, the Direction de la Surveillance du Territoire, or DST. But for the field command post, Gabriel required a proper safe house. It was Arish Hamron, from his fortress-like home in Tiberias, who offered a solution. He had a friend, a well-to-do Moroccan Jewish businessman, who had fled the country in 1967 after the cataclysm of the Six-Day War, who still owned a large villa in the old colonial section of Casablanca. At present, the villa was unoccupied, save for a pair of guardians who lived in a guest house on the property. Shamron recommended an outright sale over a short-term rental, and Gabriel readily agreed. Fortunately, money was not an issue. Dmitry Antonov, despite his recent spending spree, was still dripping with it. He wrote a check for the entirety of the purchase price and dispatched a French lawyer, in point of fact he was an officer of Alpha Group, to Casablanca to collect the deed. By day's end, the office had taken possession of a forward operating base in the heart of the city. All it needed now was Saladin. His network was quiet during those long days of planning. There were no attacks, directed or lone wolf, but ISIS's many social media channels were ablaze with chatter that something big was coming, something that would eclipse the attacks on Washington and London. It only added to the pressure inside Kingsall Boulevard and at Langley and Vauxhall Cross. Saladin needed to be removed from circulation sooner rather than later. But would his demise put a stop to the bloodshed? Would his network die with him? "Unlikely," said Dina Sarid. In fact, her greatest fear was that Saladin had built the equivalent of a dead man's switch into the network, a switch that would automatically set off a string of murderous strikes in the event of his passing. What's more, ISIS had already demonstrated a remarkable adaptability. If the physical caliphate in Iraq and Syria were lost, said Dina, they would establish a virtual caliphate instead. A cyber caliphate, as she called it. Here, the old rules would not apply. Martyrs-in-waiting would be radicalized in hidden corners of the dark web and then guided toward their targets by masterminds they had never met. Such was the brave new world that the Internet, social media, and encrypted messaging had brought about. Of more immediate concern, however, was the 300 grams of cesium chloride resting in a French government laboratory outside Paris. The cesium chloride that, as far as Saladin was concerned, was still aboard an impounded cargo ship in the port of Toulon. But had he entrusted his entire stockpile to a single clandestine shipment? Was a portion of it already in the hands of an attack cell? Would the next bomb that exploded in a European city contain a radioactive core? As the days passed with no contact from Jean-Luc Martel's Moroccan supplier, Paul Rousseau and his minister wondered whether it was time to warn their European counterparts of the elevated threat. But Gabriel, with the help of Graham Seymour and the Americans, convinced them to remain quiet. A warning, even if it were couched in routine language, risked exposing the operation. Inevitably, there would be a leak. And if it leaked, Saladin would conclude there was a link between the seizure of his drugs and the seizure of the radioactive powder hidden inside a spool of insulated wire.
"Maybe he's already reached that conclusion," said Rousseau dejectedly. "Maybe he's beaten us yet again."
Secretly, Gabriel feared the same. So too did the Americans. And during a heated, secure video conference on the second Friday of August, they renewed their demand that Gabriel hand over Jean-Luc Martel and thus his operation to Langley's control. Gabriel objected, and when the Americans pressed their case, he took the only course available to him. He wished the Americans a pleasant weekend. Then he rang Chiara and informed her they were going to Tiberias for Shabbat dinner. Chapter 45. Tiberias, Israel. Tiberias, one of Judaism's four holy cities, lies on the western shore of the body of water that most of the world refers to as the Sea of Galilee, and Israelis call Lake Kinneret. Just beyond its outskirts there is a small moshav of Kfar Hittim, which stands on the spot where the real Saladin, on a blazing summer afternoon in 1187, defeated the thirst-crazed armies of the Crusaders in a climactic battle that would leave Jerusalem once again in Muslim hands. He had shown his vanquished enemies no mercy. In his tent he had personally sliced off the arm of Reynald of Châtillon after the Frenchman refused to convert to Islam. The rest of the surviving Crusaders he condemned to execution by decapitation, the prescribed punishment for unbelievers. A kilometer or so to the north of Kfar Hittim was a rocky escarpment that overlooked both the lake and the scalding plain where the ancient battle had occurred. And it was there, of all places, that Ari Shamron had chosen to make his home. He claimed that when the wind was right, he could hear the clashing of swords and the screams of the dying. They reminded him, or so he said, of the transient nature of political and military power in this turbulent corner of the eastern Mediterranean. Canaanites, Hittites, Amalekites, Moabites, Greeks, Romans, Persians, Arabs, Turks, British, all had come and gone. Against overwhelming odds, the Jews had managed to pull off one of history's greatest second acts. 2 millennia after the fall of the Second Temple, they had come back for a return engagement. But if history were a guide, they were already on borrowed time. There are few people who can claim to have helped to build a country, and fewer still, an intelligence service. Ari Shamron, however, had managed to accomplish both. Born in eastern Poland, he immigrated to British-ruled Palestine in 1937 as disaster loomed over the Jews of Europe, and had fought in the war that followed the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. In the aftermath of the conflict, with the Arab world vowing to strangle the new Jewish state in its infancy, he joined a small organization that insiders referred to only as the Office. Among his first assignments was to identify and assassinate several Nazi scientists who were helping Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser build an atomic bomb. But the crowning achievement of his career as a field operative would come not in the Middle East, but on a street corner in the industrial Buenos Aires suburb of San Fernando. There, on a rainy night in May 1960, he dragged Adolf Eichmann, the station master of the Final Solution, into the back of a waiting car
the first stop on a journey that for Eichmann would end in an Israeli noose. For Shamron, however, it was only the beginning. Within a few short years, the intelligence service he joined at his creation would be his to run, and the country would be his to protect. From his lair inside King Saul Boulevard, with its gunmetal gray filing cabinets and permanent stench of Turkish tobacco, he penetrated the courts of kings, stole the secrets of tyrants, and killed countless enemies. His tenure as chief lasted longer than any of his predecessors. And in the late 1990s, after a string of botched operations, he was dragged happily out of retirement to right the ship and restore the office to its former glory. He found an accomplice in a grieving field operative who had locked himself away in a small cottage at the edge of the Helford Passage in Cornwall. Now, at long last, the field operative was the chief, and the burden of protecting Shamron's two creations, a country and an intelligence service, was his to bear. Shamron had been chosen for the Eichmann mission because of his hands, which were unusually large and powerful for so small a man. They were bunched atop his olive-wood cane when Gabriel entered the house with a child in each arm. He entrusted them to Shamron and returned to his armored SUV to collect three platters of food that Kiara had spent the afternoon preparing. Gila, Shamron's long-suffering wife, lit the candles at sundown, while Shamron, in the Yiddish intonations of his Polish youth, recited the blessings of the bread and the wine. For a brief moment it seemed to Gabriel that there was no operation and no Saladin, only his family and his faith. It did not last long. Indeed, throughout the meal, as the others gossiped about politics and lamented the matzav, the situation, Gabriel's attention wandered time and again to his mobile phone. Shamron, watching from his place at the head of the table, smiled. He offered no words of sympathy over Gabriel's obvious discomfort. For Shamron, operations were like oxygen. Even a bad operation was better than no operation at all. When the meal was over, Gabriel followed Shamron downstairs to the room that doubled as his study and workshop. The innards of an antique radio lay scattered across his work table, like the debris of a bombing. Shamron sat down, and with a snap of his old Zippo lighter, ignited one of his wretched Turkish cigarettes. Gabriel battered away the smoke and pondered the memorabilia arranged neatly on the shelves. His eye fell instantly upon a framed photograph of Shamron and Golda Meir, taken on the day she ordered him to send forth the boys to avenge the 11 Israeli coaches and athletes murdered at the Munich Olympic Games. Next to the photograph was a glass case about the size of a cigar box. Inside, mounted on a background of black cloth, were 11 22-caliber shell casings.
"I've been saving those for you," said Shamron.
"I don't want them."
"Why not?" "They're macabre. You are the one who figured out how to squeeze 11 rounds into a 10-shot magazine, not me.
Maybe I'm afraid that one day someone will have a box like that on his shelf with my name on it."
"Someone already does, my son."
Shamron switched on his magnifying work lamp.
"You're showing remarkable restraint." "How so?"
"You haven't asked me once about the operation."
"Why would I do that?"
"Because you're pathologically incapable of minding your own business."
"Which is why I'm a spy."
He adjusted the magnifying lamp and scrutinized a worn-out piece of circuitry.
"What kind of radio is it?" "An RCA Art Deco model, with a marbleized Catalina polymer covering. Standard and shortwave. It was manufactured in 1946. Imagine," said Shamron, pointing out the original paper sticker on the base. "Somewhere in America in 1946, someone was putting together this radio, while people like your mother and father were trying to put together their lives."
"It's a radio, Ari. It had nothing to do with the Shoah."
"I was just making an observation," Shamron smiled. "You seem tense. Is something bothering you?"
"No, not at all." They lapsed into silence while Shamron tinkered. Repairing old radios was his only hobby, other than meddling in Gabriel's life.
"Uzi tells me you're thinking about going to Morocco," he said at last.
"Why would he do a thing like that?"
"Because he couldn't talk you out of it.
and he thought I could. I haven't made a final decision. But you've asked the Americans to renew your passport.
Reactivate, said Gabriel.
Renew, reactivate, what difference does it make? You never should have accepted it in the first place. It belongs in a little glass coffin like those shell casings. It's proven useful on numerous occasions.
Blue and white, said Shamron. We do things for ourselves, and we don't help others with problems of their own making.
Maybe once, answered Gabriel, but we can't operate like that any longer. We need partners.
Partners have a way of disappointing you, and that passport won't protect you if something goes wrong in Morocco.
Gabriel picked up the little display case with the spent 22 rounds. If my memory is correct, and I'm sure it is, you were in the back seat of a car in the Piazza Anibaliano while I was inside that apartment house dealing with Zweiter.
I was the chief of special ops then. It was my place to be in the field. A more appropriate analogy, Shamron went on, would be Abu Jihad. I was the chief then, and I stayed aboard that naval vessel while you and the rest of the team went ashore.
With the defense minister, as I recall.
It was an important operation. Almost as important, said Shamron quietly, as the one you're about to carry out. It's time for Saladin to leave the stage with no encores or curtain calls. Just make sure you don't give him what he really wants.
What's that?
You.
Gabriel returned the case to its place on the shelf.
Will you permit me a question or two? Asked Shamron.
If it will make you happy.
Bolt holes?
Gabriel explained that there would be two. One was an Israeli corvette. The other was the Neptune, a Liberian-registered cargo vessel that in reality was a floating radar and eavesdropping station operated by Amman, Israel's military intelligence service. The Neptune would be stationed off Agadir on Morocco's Atlantic coast.
And the corvette? Asked Shamron.
A little Mediterranean port called El Jebba.
I assume that's where the Sayeret team will come ashore.
If I require it. After all, said Gabriel, I have a former Sayeret officer and a veteran of the British Special Air Service at my disposal.
Both of whom will have their hands full maintaining control of this Jean-Luc Martel character.
Shamron shook his head slowly.
Sometimes the worst thing about a successful recruitment is that you're stuck with the asset. Whatever you do, don't trust him.
I wouldn't dream of it. Shamron's cigarette had extinguished itself. He lit another and returned to work on the radio, while Gabriel stared at the photograph on the shelf, trying to reconcile the black-and-white image of a spymaster in his prime with the elderly figure before him. It had happened so quickly. Soon, he thought, it would happen to him. Not even Raphael and Irene could stave off the inevitable.
"Aren't you going to get that?"
Shamron asked suddenly. "Get what?"
"Your phone. It's driving me to distraction."
Gabriel looked down. He had been so lost in thought, he hadn't noticed the message from the Ramatuel safe house.
"Well?"
asked Shamron.
"It seems Mohammed Bakar would like a word with Jean-Luc Martel about those missing drugs."
He was wondering whether he could come to Morocco early next week.
"Will he be free?"
"Martel? I think we can fit it into his schedule." Smiling, Shamron plugged the radio into the power strip on his work table and switched it on. A moment later, after adjusting the tuning dial, he found a bit of music. "I don't recognize it," said Gabriel.
"You wouldn't. You're too young. It's Artie Shaw. The first time I heard this."
He left the thought unfinished. "What's it called?" asked Gabriel.
"You're a lucky guy."
Just then the radio died, and the music fell silent. Shamron frowned.
"Or maybe not."
Chapter 46. Casablanca, Morocco. The road linking Casablanca's Mohammed V International Airport with the center of Morocco's largest city and financial hub was four lanes of smooth, coal-black asphalt,
along which Dina Sarid, a reckless motorist by nature and nationality, drove with extraordinary care. "What are you so worried about?" asked Gabriel.
"You,"
she replied. "What have I done now?"
"Nothing. I've just never driven the chief before."
"Well," he said, staring out his window, "it's the first time for everything." Gabriel's overnight bag lay on the back seat. His attaché case was balanced on his knees. In it was the American passport that had allowed him to sail unmolested through Moroccan border control and customs. Things might have changed in Washington, but in much of the world it was still good to be an American. All at once the traffic slowed to a halt.
"A checkpoint," explained Dina. "They're everywhere."
"What do you suppose they're looking for?"
"Maybe the chief of Israeli intelligence."
A line of orange pylons guided the traffic onto the shoulder of the road, where a pair of gendarmes was inspecting the vehicles and their occupants, watched over by a DST tough in plain clothes and sunglasses. While lowering her window, Dina spoke a few words to Gabriel in fluent German, German being the language of her cover identity and false passport. The bored gendarme waved her forward, as though they were chasing away the flies. The DST man's thoughts were clearly elsewhere. Dina quickly raised her window against the heavy, merciless heat and turned the air conditioner on full. They passed a large military installation. Then it was farmland again, small plots of rich, dark earth, tended mainly by inhabitants of the surrounding villages. The sands of eucalyptus reminded Gabriel of home. At last they reached the ragged edges of Casablanca, North Africa's second-largest city, eclipsed only by the megalopolis of Cairo. The farmland did not surrender entirely. There were patches of it between the smart new apartment blocks and the shanty towns of corrugated metal and cinder block shacks that were home to hundreds of thousands of Casablanca's poorest residents. "They call them bidonvilles," said Dina, pointing out one of the shanty towns. "I suppose it sounds better than a slum. The people there have nothing, no running water, barely enough to eat. Every once in a while the government tries to clear away the bidonvilles with bulldozers, but the people come back and rebuild. What choice do they have? They have nowhere else to go." They passed a plot of thin brown grass, where two barefoot boys were watching over a flock of skinny goats. "The one thing they do have in the bidonvilles," Dina was saying, "is Islam. And thanks to Wahhabi and Salafist preachers, it's getting more and more extreme. Do you remember the attack in 2003? All those boys who blew themselves up came from the bidonvilles of Sidi Mouman." Gabriel did remember the attacks, of course, but in much of the West they were largely forgotten. 14 bombings against mainly Western and Jewish targets, 45 dead, more than 100 wounded. They were the work of an Al-Qaeda affiliate known as Salafia Jihadia, which in turn had ties to the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group. For all its natural beauty and Western tourism, Morocco remained a hotbed of radical Islam where ISIS had managed to establish deep roots and numerous cells. More than 1,300 Moroccans had traveled to the caliphate to fight for ISIS, along with several hundred more ethnic Moroccans from France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, and Moroccans had played an outsized role in ISIS's recent terror campaign in Western Europe. And then there was Mohamed Bouyeri, the Dutch-Moroccan who shot and stabbed filmmaker and writer Theo van Gogh on a street in Amsterdam. The killing was not the spontaneous act of one troubled man. Bouyeri was a member of a cell of radical North African Muslims based in The Hague, known as the Hofstad Network. For the most part, Morocco's security services had managed to deflect the country's extremism outward. Still, there were plenty of plots at home. Morocco's interior ministry had boasted recently that it had broken up more than 300 terror plots, including one involving mustard gas. There were some things, thought Gabriel, that were better left unsaid. They breasted a hill, and the pale blue Atlantic opened before them. The Morocco Mall, with its futuristic IMAX movie theater and Western boutiques, occupied a newly developed stretch of land along the coast. Dina followed the corniche toward downtown, past beach clubs and restaurants and sparkling white seafront villas. One was the size of a commercial building. "It belongs to a Saudi prince. And over there," said Dina, "is the Four Seasons." She slowed so Gabriel could have a look. At the gated entrance to the grounds, two security guards in dark suits were searching the undercarriage of an arriving car for explosives.
Only if it passed inspection would it be allowed to proceed along the drive to the hotel's covered motor court.
"There's a magnetometer just inside the door," said Dina. "All bags and guests, no exceptions. We'll have to bring the guns in from the beach. It won't be a problem."
"Think the boys from Salafia Jihadia know that, too?"
"I hope not," said Dina with a rare smile.
They continued along the corniche, past the massive Hassan II Mosque, the outer walls of the ancient Medina, and the sprawling port. Finally, they entered Casablanca's old French colonial center, with its wide, curving boulevards and its unique blend of Moorish Art Nouveau and Art Deco architecture. It had once been a place where cosmopolitan Casablancans strolled elegant colonnades dressed in the latest fashions from Paris and dined in some of the world's finest restaurants. Now it was a monument to decay and danger. Soot blackened the floral stucco facades, rust rotted the wrought iron balustrades. The smart set kept to the trendy quartiers of Gautier and Maharif, leaving old Casablanca to the robed, the veiled, and the street vendors who sold spoiled fruit and cheap cassettes of sermons and Quranic verses. The one sign of progress was the shining new streetcar that snaked along the Boulevard Mohammed V, past the boarded-up shops and the arcades where the homeless dozed on beds of cardboard. Dina followed a tram for several blocks and then turned into a narrow side street and parked. On one side was an 8-story apartment building that looked as though it were about to collapse beneath the weight of the satellite dishes sprouting like mushrooms from the balconies. On the other was a crumbling, vine-covered wall with a once ornate cedar door. Guarding it was a panting, feral dog.
"Why are we stopping?" asked Gabriel.
"We're here."
"Where?"
"The command post."
"You're joking."
"No."
Gabriel eyed the canine warily.
"What about him?"
"He's harmless. It's the rats you have to worry about."
Just then, one scurried past along the pavement. It was the size of a raccoon. The dog recoiled in fear. So did Gabriel.
"Maybe we should go back to the Four Seasons."
"It's not safe."
"Neither is this place."
"It's not so bad once you get used to it."
"What's it like on the inside?"
Dina switched off the engine.
"It's haunted. But otherwise it's quite nice."
They sidestepped the panting dog and passed through the cedar doorway into a hidden paradise. There was an azure-blue swimming pool, a red clay tennis court, and a seemingly endless garden of bougainvillea, hibiscus, banana trees, and date palms. The immense house was built in the Moroccan tradition with tiled interior courtyards where the incessant murmur of Casablanca faded to silence. The labyrinthine rooms seemed frozen in time. It might have been 1967, the year the owner tossed a few belongings into a bag and fled to Israel. Or perhaps, thought Gabriel, it was a more genteel age, an age when everyone in the neighborhood spoke French and worried about how long it would be before the Germans were parading down the Champs-Élysées. The two caretakers were named Tarek and Hamid. They had purchased the job from the previous caretakers who had grown too old to look after the place. They avoided the interior of the house, keeping to the gardens and the small guest cottage instead. Their wives, children, and grandchildren lived in a nearby Bidonville.
"We're the new owners," said Gabriel. "Why can't we just fire them?"
"Bad idea," said Yaakov Rossman.
Before transferring to the office, Yaakov had worked for Shabak, Israel's internal security service, running agents in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. He spoke fluent Arabic and was an expert on Arab and Islamic cultures.
"If we try to let them go, it will cause an uproar. It would be bad for our cover.
So we'll give them a generous severance package."
"That's an even worse idea. Every relative they have from every corner of the country will be pouring through our door looking for money."
Yaakov shook his head reproachfully.
"You really don't know much about these people, do you?"
"So we keep the caretakers," said Gabriel. "But what's this nonsense about the place being haunted?" They were standing in the cool silence of the house's main internal courtyard. Yaakov glanced nervously at Dina, who in turn looked at Elie Lavon. It was Lavon, Gabriel's oldest friend in the world, who eventually answered.
"Her name is Aisha."
"Mohammed's wife?"
"Not that Aisha. Different Aisha."
"Different how?"
"Aisha is a jinn."
"A what?"
"A demon."
Gabriel looked to Yaakov for a fuller explanation.
Muslims believe that Allah fashioned men out of clay, the jinns he made from fire.
Is that bad?
Very. By day the jinns live among us, in inanimate objects, leading lives quite like ours, but they come out after dark, in any form they desire.
They're shapeshifters, said Gabriel dubiously.
And wicked, said Yaakov, nodding gravely.